Ladies and gentlemen, a few weeks ago, we had great pleasure in welcoming a former colleague, Mr. Cedric Thornbury, who gave the first of our centenary public lectures, and it was a double pleasure to introduce him because he was returning to where he had been a lecturer before his elevation to higher things. And this evening, I'm delighted to see him in the audience again tonight. This evening, it's an equal pleasure to welcome Robert Hunter, Ambassador Robert Hunter, the American Permanent Representative on the North Atlantic Council, who also started life longer ago than those of us in the relevant age bracket would like to admit, as a lecturer in the International Relations Department. And it's a great pleasure and honour to be able to welcome an old colleague who has also risen to such elevated heights back to grace the LSE Centenary Lecture Series this evening. I was reminded that he and I, between us, have clocked up more than a quarter of the LSE's 100 years when I tried to check on his biography in the American Who's Who, which is a bit like the longer Oxford Dictionary reduced. You have to invest in a special magnifying glass, particularly if you are over the age of 45, to read the entries. But for those of you who don't know Robert, after he left the LSE in 1969, he served in a number of capacities in Washington. During the Carter presidency, he was in the National Security Council. He was, for several years, foreign policy advisor to Senator Edward Kennedy. He took an active part in the Democratic presidential campaigns for Humphrey and Mondale, and of course he is an author in his own right and a very well-known commentator in Washington on European, Middle Eastern, and security affairs, all of which qualifies him, apart from his public position, which he holds, to talk to us in this centenary series on America, Europe, and security in the new century. Robert Hunter, welcome.
Thank you very much, James. It's an honor to be back here at the London School of Economics, where I spent so many, it seems, of my formative years. And more to the point, where I met a woman who's sitting down here named Shireen Hunter, who is now my bride. So what I may have lacked in an education, I gained in a lifetime companion, and that was certainly worth being here. It's also good to see so many old friends here at the LSE and to be back here again. When I became a diplomat for the first time under this administration, I had to calculate exactly what it was going to be like going over to Brussels to represent my country at NATO. And I went back through the annals and I discovered that it was said best as one would be the wont by one of Britain's leading diplomats of the 17th century, Sir Henry Wotton, who was in Venice at the time, who wrote the famous saying that a diplomat is an honest man sent abroad to lie for his country. I've discovered, however, it's quite different being where I am in Brussels. It's an average American sent to Brussels to get fat for his country, and I'm doing just that. I was taught also here how to be quick on my feet, and particularly how to deal with that famous institution across the road called Bush House, which in those days paid our way through graduate school, in particular how to keep out of a jam. And I remember I used this to good facility a few years ago, back before the Iron Curtain fell, when there was some question about Mr. Honecker, who was then the head of East Germany, the then East Germany. And I was interviewed on CNN, and they said, how long do you think Mr. Honecker's going to last. Well, I thought very quickly, you know, and understood that if I said something that didn't come up quite right, I could probably very quickly be caught out. So I came up with an obviously safe answer, and I said, oh, I don't know how long he's going to last. Anywhere between 2 days and 2 years. Wrong again, it was 1 day. So we shall see how long tonight's lecture will sustain me. By the standards of some universities in the provinces, and I mean, of course, Oxford and Cambridge, the London School of Economics and Political Science is an infant. The LSE's mere 100 years may seem a short passage in the life of institutions that can call a college new that sports a span of some 616 years, but what a century it has been. It can be seen in the life of the school, which now spreads its influence to every part of the globe, and which for so long has had few if any peers in its chosen fields. And it can be seen in the vast changes in society, both domestic and international, that are the proper study of the LSE. Today I will dwell for a few moments on what Europe and America bring to one another in providing the blessings of security for all of our peoples, not just for now, but into the new century. Yet I think we have to start by recalling just what has happened in the short 10 decades since Bernard Shaw and the family Webb turned their joint and several inspirations into this place of intellectual ferment, struggle, growth, and insight. The Webbs understood what they called the inevitability of gradualness, and in looking at this great school today, how right they were. At LSE's birth, America was a faraway country, deliberately innocent of the cares of the countries that gave birth to most forebears of our largely immigrant nation. Washington and Jefferson had warned against entangling alliances, and their strictures sufficed well into the adolescence of the London School. At LSE's silver anniversary in 1920, America had abandoned that seemingly prudent policy to help turn the tide of a great world war, but was just as quickly receding into renewed indifference to Europe's strategic fate. By halftime in the LSE century, however, America was now in Europe to stay. Over there, of the 1418 war, had been replaced in World War II England by an ironic, but if I may say so, I believe, affectionate, over here. And may I say, we Americans are now over here to stay. As we meet this afternoon, we are a few days short of commemorating the end of the most horrendous of Europe's many wars. For my country, the lesson of that country was made clear within 2 years of VE Day. Twice bitten, thrice shy. This time, the United States rapidly reversed the withdrawal from European shores that naturally followed victory in Europe. What followed was the Marshall Plan. It was not just, in Winston Churchill's flattering words, the most unsordid act in history. It was also a clear understanding by the people of the United States that our destiny and yours had become inseparable. The Marshall Plan was about economic recovery for all European states which took part, and it was about democracy for those which had labored under fascism's heavy curse. And thus, it was about security in the deepest sense of the term. The Washington Treaty followed in 1949, not as a full-blown alliance, but at first as an American strategic commitment to the future of Western Europe, a critically needed underpinning sought most effectively by Britain's Ernest Bevin to the work of the Marshall Plan. This North Atlantic Treaty provided confidence that the labors of European peoples would not be in vain. 2 years later, NATO itself came into being. For the next 38 years, it held the line against Soviet intimidation and threat of aggression, while what the West was and what it did and what courageous peoples in the East were and did hollowed out communism and consigned it to Mr. Lenin's dustbin of history. 1989 became a year of miracles, which enshrined it in democracy's annals with 1776 and 1848. Communism was finally discredited in fact as well as in theory. The Soviet Union began the most profound peacetime retreat in all of history and then collapsed. The strength of Western democratic values and beliefs received an added stunning validation. And tens of millions of people emerged from the shadows of Soviet power, and for some, the better part of a century in which choice and individuality had been denied. Not least, Europe gained its best chance, perhaps ever, of building a lasting security that goes beyond the notion of balance of power. Today we are legatees of the victory for the deepest and most cherished of human values represented by the end of the Cold War. This was victory in four parts, not just military victory, but also social, political, and economic. Yet that is also a measure of the sweeping demands imposed by the end of the Cold War. Together, Europeans and North Americans, we now face an historic challenge as important for our time as any other in Europe during this century. We are charged to help make good on promises to former communist societies that they too can pursue the benefits of democracy and free market economies. We also have a chance, but just how big a chance we cannot yet tell, to help nurture a former adversary, Russia, to become a partner. One thing is clear. A decade or two from now, those who come after us, who write the history of what we did at this time when LSE turned 100, will judge us with the absolute clarity of hindsight by simple standard. Whether what we did now, however imperfect our vision and experimental our efforts, helped to bring into being a Europe that could indeed be sustained as whole and free, or whether this generation failed its particular rendezvous with destiny. Of course, we must not inflate what we are able to do. Transforming societies that languished under communism is not just a matter of willpower, certainly not on the part of strangers to each country's unique experience and possibilities. The end of the Cold War has issued an invitation for them to join the West, to form the attitudes and practices that must underpin free societies and prosperous market economies. But most of what is achieved will arise from the efforts of individual men and women in the countries of Central Europe and beyond, just as they wrested command of their destinies in launching the revolutions of 1989 that so many outsiders knew to be impossible. But we do have a part to play in building a new security in Europe that can write a fitting and hopeful end to a century that began in innocence of the great follies, crimes, and tragedies to come. No doubt, spreading security broadly across the continent must begin by sustaining what has been achieved. That includes America's continued strategic engagement on the continent. That commitment, which was so often questioned on this side of the Atlantic when so much depended upon its credibility during the Cold War, is now a settled question in the United States. And why not? Save for our own Civil War 130 years ago, the American people have expended more blood and more treasure on pursuit of a single goal: to keep Europe free of domination by hostile and undemocratic powers, than on anything else we have done in our entire history. We have done this because of the oneness of our strategic purpose in Europe, collective economic interests bridging the Atlantic, and a shared set of values that in fact define the American nation. This is not 1919, when only an Alcock and Brown could cross the Atlantic in less than a week. It's not 1946 when the crackling of the transatlantic telephone conveyed only a handful of messages at once. If anything, the world is too much with us. But that fact also makes our two peoples inseparable. In the wake of so much change, let me recall one central truth. This American commitment to Europe's future doesn't depend on any one president, on any one Congress, or on any one political party. To be swept this way or that with the outcome of each new election. It is, in fact, a national obligation woven into our political fabric. One of the founders of the school, I think, put it very well on a rare visit he made to the United States, George Bernard Shaw. He said, "You in America should trust to that volcanic political instinct which I have divined in you." It's one thing about our country. We may be slow to anger when it comes to the kinds of commitments we show here, but when we are risen to that anger and to the demonstration of that commitment, then there is no power on earth that we know can stand against it. And that, I think, in our common democratic future, is something of which we can all be deeply proud and deeply concerned to see continue. One earnest of this American commitment can be found in the continued deployment here in Europe of about 100,000 U.S. troops for as far ahead as we can see, a commitment ratified by this new Congress just as it was by the old. Today, many of these American men and women in uniform are engaged in work radically different from that of the Cold War era. Along with many of our allies, U.S. troops in Europe are working with their counterparts throughout the rest of Europe, helping to instill the attitudes and practices of democracy in the militaries of former communist countries at the level that matters most, that of the individual soldier, sailor, and airman. Tomorrow's security in Europe also depends upon preserving the past half century's spectacular achievements in this part of the continent. When World War II ended, even the most visionary statesman could hardly conceive that at this time it has become unthinkable that leading adversaries of mankind's two most destructive conflicts could ever again fight one another. Three times in 80 years, France and Germany went to war. Today, that idea is absurd, in large measure because of what people here in Europe began 50 years ago this week. The countries which belong to the European Union have done nothing less than abolish war in their relations with one another. In the parlance of where I live in Brussels, they've created a European civil space which has no historic precedent among diverse societies. But it's up to us to make sure that this civil space endures, not just for the next few years, but for future generations as well. But whereas my country's search for security will not let us stop at the water's edge, neither here in Europe can the search for security stop at the far edge of NATO, the far edge of the European Union. Perhaps we could preserve what we have as little North Atlanticists without regard to what happens beyond. But I doubt it. Such insularity in the face of the promise of newly free societies, yet uncertain of their futures, would be morally and politically bankrupt. It would, in my judgment, also be a default on our responsibility, not just to them, but also to ourselves. We cannot retain a lasting security in the North Atlantic region if we do not also become deeply involved and deeply responsible for security farther east as well. Most Central European societies are still at the fledgling stage of creating democracies and free market economies. Many remain burdened by the role of nationalism in defining who they are. intense nationalism helped preserve hope at the time of communism, but it now impedes integration in broader Western society. The end of the Cold War brought with it the unfreezing of history. When old animosities gained fresh life in the absence of the transforming benefits that were brought to Western society by a half century of freedom and prosperity. What we see in Bosnia today is an anachronism, but nevertheless deadly in its effects, and a measure of what must be done if Central Europe is not again to become the seedbed of a European or even global catastrophe. Bringing the nations of Central Europe into the West is today's most obvious demand of security. This can help them treat both cause and effect of ancient, unresolved disputes and discord. It can reduce uncertainty stemming from an imprecise sense of destiny in regard to their neighbors. And linking peoples of Central Europe to Western democratic society can nurture an underlying sense of confidence for men and women who really want most to turn their newly liberated energies to tasks of family, of community, and of nation building. This particular notion of security in Central Europe flows naturally from what was done here a half century ago with the Marshall Plan and then the Washington Treaty. It recognizes that societies with a history of Western engagement do have good prospects to re-engage themselves with the West during the next few years ahead. But one further exigency can dwarf all the others. The question of Russia. This one society of nearly 150 million people, the largest landmass on Earth, spanning 11 time zones, is engaged in its history's most serious struggle to join the modern Western world. We have a critical stake in Russia's future, a critical stake in its success in creating democracy, a free market economy, shared respect with its neighbors, and a productive role in the outside world. Indeed, involving and not isolating Russia will likely prove to be the essential test of European security for the years ahead. More than half a century ago, Churchill called upon America to give us the tools and we will finish the job. Today, the tools are different. Security in Europe does not now depend upon an arsenal of democracy, but upon political will, resources to transform economies, and great institutions. During the past half century, countries and peoples in the transatlantic world have learned to work together more effectively, more creatively than ever before, in a vast array of institutions that submerge national differences beneath the pursuit of common interests. As we build a lasting security in Europe, three institutions of proven worth now stand out. The European Union helps to guard the future in the West, and it must now help societies in Central Europe meet the aspirations of their peoples. This is basic, not just to free market economies, but also to democracy and social transformation. Meanwhile, the newly christened Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe embraces all European states, plus Canada and the United States. All members spanning the hemisphere from Vancouver to Vladivostok are equal. All subscribe to the same principles of national conduct, and all can find help in resolving minor tensions and conflicts. But most important is NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization renews its service to Europe's security by the very fact that it exists. Unlike all of history's other alliances, It did not dissolve when its initial work was done. It did not splinter common purpose into many parts. Its 16 members did not go their separate ways, each of them seeking to protect its future through an inward national solution. When the Allies think European security, they think NATO. Virtually all commit their military forces to the Alliance's integrated commands. Their military forces are crafted to the same set of standards. These compelling habits of mind, of form, and of action are the bedrock of Western efforts to project security and stability from the shores of the Atlantic into the heart of the continent. NATO also brings to bear American power and purpose. It is through this institution, with support at home that is forged from both principle and experience, that the United States will remain engaged in Europe's security. Once again, America is also leading the alliance. As NATO has reformed and transformed to meet demands of security beyond limits once imposed by the Cold War. Less than a year and a half ago, President Clinton came to Brussels and led the alliance into new territory. NATO is now adapting its military commands and forces for action that does not require the full power of Allied Command Europe or Allied Command Atlantic. NATO now gives its unstinting political and military support to Western European Union. NATO is alert to dangers from the spread of weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering them. It continues to play its part in containing the conflict in Bosnia, reducing human suffering and promoting peace diplomacy. Most important, however, NATO has already made its decisions to help foster security beyond its old frontiers. In 1991, it founded the North Atlantic Cooperation Council, an association of NATO and former Warsaw Pact states, and thereby enlarged the scope of its concerns. NATO is now in Central Europe. NATO has already expanded, and it's there to stay. As a defensive alliance, it confronts no nation, nor does it respond to threat from any quarter, save one, the threat from instability and uncertainty that faces all European states in common. At the NATO summit in January 1994, President Clinton led the NATO allies in agreeing to take in new members. Ministers reaffirmed that commitment last December. And in enlarging the alliance, we're determined to increase security for all and diminish it for none. NATO, however, does not derive its strength from paper pledges based on the needs of the moment. That way lies the 1930s. Rather, it derives its strength from the mutual, enduring pledges of its several nations. Thus, when we extend the NATO compact to new members, each of them must pass the scrutiny and gain the support of all 16 Allied parliaments. We also must assure ourselves that candidates to join NATO are serious about their association with us, serious about their own security, and yes, serious also about the security of their neighbors. In short, they must become producers and not only consumers of security. NATO's duties in Europe's new security, however, can't stop just with taking in new members. Just as important, those countries which do not join must also be able to partake of the increase that NATO, the European Union, OSCE, and other institutions can bring. No matter how many countries NATO admits on the first day, some of which to join will not be in that number. They too have to know that they can have a deep and a permanent engagement with NATO. They have to know that they can be with us as part of the NATO family, even if they don't actually become members and don't gain the guarantee itself. We would gain very little if in enlarging the compass of alliance membership we forced a division of Europe, the drawing of new lines, the return to a sterile partition between us and them. Today's claim on European security statecraft centers on spreading security eastward without thereby driving any country into isolation or into wrongly assuming that its own security is diminished. Not least, NATO's enlargement is not directed against Russia. It is not directed against Russian democratic leaders struggling to create a new society, its roots sunk in humane values, and its just powers deriving from the consent of the governed. NATO's acts to extend stability to Central Europe are profoundly in the interests of Russia, a country which also has suffered so much from uncertainty in that very consequential part of Europe. This year, NATO has embarked upon three parallel efforts. They reinforce one another, and they are designed to increase the corpus of European security. We have a clear view of the strategic future, agreed by all 16 allies. 1995 is the year in which that view is beginning to become reality. It will not be finished this year. It will not be finished before the end of the century. But we are confident that we now have a vision to which we can all be committed that will help us to engage these countries who are yearning to be part of the West. Today, the NATO alliance is examining the how and the why of enlarging, preparing itself to take in new members in the best way possible. The NATO allies have to know how NATO will change when we take in new members, and the candidates for membership must know what to expect. We've told them, all new members of NATO will be full members of the alliance. They will enjoy the rights, but they will also assume all the obligations of membership in NATO. In a few weeks, this work of studying the future, studying the best means of enlarging NATO, will be completed. Beginning in September, NATO will share the results with countries in the East that are interested. It will then be ready to consider its next steps, leading towards decisions on the who and the when of membership in NATO. NATO is also doing a lot more. Last year, President Clinton proposed, and the alliance agreed, to create what we call the Partnership for Peace. In a few short months, this partnership has proved to be the most important strategic development in European security since the Cold War, and one of the most important initiatives in all of NATO's history. 26 countries have now joined the Partnership for Peace. That includes the traditional neutrals and virtually every country to emerge from the wreckage of the Warsaw Pact and the dissolved Soviet Union. Each partner is joined on equal terms. Each has agreed to the same broad framework of cooperation and democratic principles. But each member can also distinguish itself by the degree to which it is ready, willing, and able to work with the NATO alliance. Partnership for Peace fulfills two broad and very important purposes. For some countries, it is the essential way station to NATO membership, the transition to becoming an effective ally, to being a country that can be a producer and not just a consumer of security. For other countries, Partnership for Peace provides a permanent association with NATO, a linkage to virtually all that NATO is and does. In fact, a country that's deeply engaged in the partnership gets everything from NATO membership except the formal security guarantee provided by the Washington Treaty and actual membership in the integrated military structure. Devoted partners will adopt NATO standards, standards of parliamentary control as well as military weapons. They'll train with NATO forces, exercise with them, and if they choose, go into action with NATO alongside the Allies. Let me submit that this is not the stuff of which strategic vacuums are made. It's the stuff of engagement, confidence, and security. NATO's new architecture for European security, however, will not be complete until we succeed in reaching out to Russia. Russia's importance is undeniable, but so too is our resolve to draw it productively into the West if we can. And those decisions, in large respect, do not depend on us. Our resolve to help it play a positive role in Europe's security. The 16 allies therefore propose to create a direct relationship between NATO and Russia, an open, transparent relationship, free of surprises, based on mutual respect and clear understanding that each side will make its own basic decisions without interference from the other. At NATO, we are ready to give Russia a voice, but not a veto over alliance decisions, including our decisions on the who, the how, and the when of NATO enlargement. We invite Russia to analyze carefully what we are and what we do to assure itself that NATO is dedicated to security throughout Europe that benefits Russia as it also benefits others. We welcome the fact that last June Russia joined the Partnership for Peace. We welcome the fact that it has negotiated the precise terms of that engagement, just like every other partner. As befitting Russia's importance, NATO and Russia have also negotiated a further agreement to broaden and deepen consultations between them. We believe that Moscow's final acceptance of these two documents is the fitting way to begin what can be a rich and productive relationship of benefit to all. Where that relationship will lead cannot clearly be seen at the start. Where it will lead will depend upon experience. But in our judgment, the possibilities are limitless for a NATO-Russia relationship, also to enhance the security of all European nations. And the time to begin that is now. With these three parallel NATO efforts, enlargement, the Partnership for Peace, and NATO-Russia relations, the alliance has clearly and firmly assumed new obligations for security in Europe, unconstrained by lines drawn in the Cold War and devoted to bringing nations in rather than pushing them out. We are determined to help the peoples of Central Europe become part of the European civil space. We are determined to build a security structure able to meet whatever challenges emerge in the future. We are determined to create a valid place for Russia in the broad scope of European society and European security. No one can now predict whether we and those who come after us will succeed. But at this most hopeful time of the 20th century, we can do our best to seize the promise that has come uniquely to this generation of Europeans and North Americans. If in that spirit we pursue a new security in Europe, then we shall surely be prepared to face history's judgment. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Ambassador Hunter has kindly indicated that he was willing to answer questions, and we have a little bit of time before our reception, so can I take questions from the floor? Dr. Margot Light.
If those countries that are not invited to join NATO are to feel secure, why should those who are invited to join not feel secure by not joining in exactly the same way?
You'll have to ask them, basically, for that, for the answer to that. We have not decided who will be invited to join NATO. essentially because we have not done yet the calculations about which countries are going to be most suited to join, those which are most prepared to take part not just in the rights but also the responsibilities, and also those who we, as we make these judgments, deem most important to have most fully integrated in NATO in order to decrease any element of uncertainty that might occur to any nation which perhaps would not be, at least initially, as committed to seeing a secure future for all of the continent. It is also, I think, clear that if we are going to maintain a capacity for NATO to be able to take effective action, there is at some point a limit both in the pace of enlargement and probably its ultimate composition, which will enable us not to become a weakened institution, let's say at the extreme, like OSCE, which also operates more or less by consensus, in which has no power whatsoever. We're also looking at it, I think, from the reverse perspective, which is all countries that will come in begin through the Partnership for Peace. All begin to have and can continue to have this very close, intimate relationship with NATO to provide what we would call a seamless relationship between those who remain just in the partnership and those coming to the alliance itself. We believe that there are a number of countries out there that have already come to the conclusion that whereas they may not be in the first ranks to join, they want to have the kind of association that I have discussed and believe that that is going to make a major and positive contribution to their security. Let me also say the following. NATO is not alone. If we also don't see efforts by the European Union and other institutions of that ilk, not just what's being now, but going far beyond, it could well be that even membership in NATO is not going to be sufficient for many of these countries to deal with the very real security threats that they could face, many of which are internal, many of which have to do with the development of their societies. NATO looks like it's going to move first, in part because we have, I think, better capacity to make this kind of decision than the European Union does. We have traditionally had a greater degree of cohesion, and I think we're expressing that again.
Dr. Sega Shugron.
As a researcher from Russia, I highly appreciate what you said about your concerns about Russia's future roles in the newly emerging system of security. Security in Europe, but what you said are mere declarations of good intentions. The problem is, while considering when and how to expand, why don't you take into consideration the impact on Russia's domestic development? So you think that Russia should be stuck to democratic development. Okay. You think that Russia should follow the lead of the West. But in the question when, I think the crucial one, don't you think that by expanding expansion of NATO, you give wrong signals to Russian nationalists before the election? Don't you think that you may play the Russian reforms and democracy into play into hands of Russian nationalists? Why don't you want to wait till the next presidential election before taking the crucial decision? Thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you for your question. Let me repeat. We have taken a decision to enlarge. That was done at the NATO summit last January. It was confirmed last December. We've taken a decision to proceed with analysis of how we should do it and why we should do it. We have not taken any decisions, in fact, we've never discussed who should become a member of NATO or when that should happen. those decisions cannot be made until after we complete this first process, until after we engage with all of those countries, members of the Partnership for Peace, who want to become engaged with us, until after we evaluate the responses, until after we look at what more may be required in order to get this right. We're not trying just to enlist people, sign them up. We could do that today. We're trying, with our eyes wide open, calculating everything that's going on, to do NATO enlargement in a way that is going to contribute to security and not diminish it. We're also putting equal emphasis on the Partnership for Peace, of which Russia is a member and has an opportunity to have a very deep relationship with us. We're also moving forward with this direct discussion, which has had a lot of rounds so far and will be carried on further during President Clinton's visit to Moscow, which is coming up next week. Clearly, however, there's going to be a responsibility on the Russian side, a responsibility of its leadership to see clearly what we're doing and to see what we're not doing and to portray that to its people. We are not deploying NATO forces on the Russian frontier. We are not adopting stance. We are not drawing new lines of division. We are not isolating Russia. You know, we're operating in an historic situation which has no precedent, in which history does not argue that we're going to succeed. But we look back at a number of other things in this century where people tried to make things happen, in the wake particularly of the Second World War, in which today become commonplace. In 1919, for example, the victorious powers stigmatized Germany, isolated it, imposed heavy sanctions, did a number of things which, in retrospect, I think a lot of those countries would not have done, and that was one of the contributory causes to the conflicts whose end we are commemorating this week. We and the alliance took a conscious decision, therefore. We were going to treat Russia not the way Germany was treated in 1919, but the way it was treated in 1946. But it's going to be important that Russia participate in this process. And there's been a big headway made. I was part of a team that went to Moscow in February last year to explain Partnership for Peace. And we were challenged at that point on everything we were doing, including the partnership. Well, we think we answered the questions, we had the discussions, we brought people to NATO, sent people to Moscow, went back and forth over and over again. And on the 21st of June, Minister Kozarev showed up at NATO and signed the partnership. So we don't believe that this is a static process. We don't believe, to use a word out of the statesperson's heart, is a zero-sum game. We have to have the support of the Russian leadership as well and making clear to everyone that that possibility of its playing a productive role is there. At the same time, we do not choose to wait forever to get on with the business of helping to integrate Central European states in the West, including integration in NATO. We are confident that that's in Russia's interest as well. A country that itself has seen challenge and threat emanating from that region. We are in a position to do something about it where Russia isn't. We think it's mutually beneficial. But we cannot be the only ones having that perception if we're going to succeed.
Cedric Thornbury.
That he's singing. I think I'm not exactly sure I get all the words just yet. And I
I'll read it again if you'd like.
I have two questions.
Sure.
Perhaps point up my uncertainty. One of them, and they're really linked, I think. One of them is how you see the future interrelationship between NATO and OSCE, about which you made a reference to Bosnia, which has been a terrible nightmare. But I mean, NATO's role in Bosnia was fairly, about 5 miles above the ground. And I'm just wondering what kind of role the ambassador foresees in the future Europe, what kind of security concerns he feels that can relate to, and how that projection relates to how he sees the future evolution of OSCE. But I would like to say that, I think many people like me very much like the truth.
Well, I hope in time you like the words, too. There are clearly a lot of jobs to be done by a lot of institutions and a lot of individuals. One of the merits we have now, even in comparison with 1946, is the institutions are in place with a lot of history and a lot of success and a lot of added confidence that the kinds of things we're talking about have a chance of succeeding. OSCE, as I've already indicated, has the advantage that it does include everybody. It does act as custodian for some of the arms control agreements that are still there and still important. And it has a capacity to deal with some low-level tensions and conflicts. At NATO, one of the aspects of the Partnership for Peace is that members in good standing can come to us for consultations more or less under Article 4 of the Washington Treaty, which is the step that's taken before you go to Article 5 and talk about military action. But we don't want countries to come to us with every small dispute or border problem. There are other places to go, and OSCE is one of those. So we see these as complementary. But let's make no mistake. When it comes to a robust use of military power, where it comes to confidence in the American military engagement, NATO is the place where that's going to happen. So there is a complementary relationship. Now, in terms of what I think we can do, let's be clear. With 16 countries, there are a set of core values and core engagements. The core values I've already described, which are in common with other institutions, including the one that we overlook all the time, that I've given the name European Civil Space to, which is an extraordinary development of attitudes that have led countries to view as absurd situations that killed 100 million people in this century. Remarkable achievement. And for some countries may be able to partake in it, some may not. But the core interests begin with the American strategic commitment to Europe, the preservation of what's been done here, the engagement in Central Europe, and trying to bring Russia into the family of nations, if you will. Beyond that, there is a penumbra, let's say, of diminishing engagement and diminishing concerns around which you can get 16 countries to agree. Now, with regard to Bosnia, I want to say a word about that. I'm glad you raised it. NATO has not acted as the institution of first resort. We've acted as second or third or last resort in many cases, in part because of the manner in which this thing occurred. The institutions were not prepared, the institutions that developed in the Cold War, were not prepared for the circumstances that arose afterwards. In fact, the European Union, then the European Community, had first effort at it, in addition to some things that were done by some individual countries, some of which were not helpful.
We're coming out against the clock. I've got two more questions.
Well, no, wait a second. When NATO was turned to, it has responded with everything it has been asked to do. Recognizing, and let me underscore this, recognizing that none of the 16 countries is prepared to sacrifice lives to change the military situation on the ground. 9 NATO countries are members of UNPROFOR. Others are involved, as we are, external to the ground war in Bosnia, but not a single allied country is prepared to act because they obviously do not think it is in their vital interest to act to change the situation on the ground. NATO blockades the Montenegrin coast. We suppress the flight of fixed-wing aircraft over Bosnia. We are ready on a minute's notice to provide close air support for UNPROFOR if asked for. the authority delegated all the way down to the NATO pilots, were prepared to engage in airstrikes if UNPROFOR will agree, and at the moment it does not. We're prepared to implement and enforce a peace agreement, and we're prepared, if asked, to put in a robust force to get UNPROFOR out if it's in danger. Now, as to what we will do in the future, that's going to be a matter of calculation and political will by the 16 allies. But I would argue the fact that we are ready to act, the fact that we are engaged in the core elements of Europe, and the fact that we have a capacity to work together to decide when small groups or large groups wish to become engaged elsewhere, I think gives us the basis to act if the political will is there. And in Bosnia, there was no collective will to change the situation on the ground.
Sorry. We're up against the clock. I've got two questions. Perhaps I can take them together and then give you the last word. Gentlemen, a second.
One of the things that helped us sustain the alliance was not only the intergovernmental cooperation and shared interests that you spoke of, but also the willingness on the part of the populations on both sides of the Atlantic in America to bear the cost of maintaining NATO, and also in Europe of American leadership. But to some degree, because the pressure of the Soviet threat has been taken off, there is a divergence of interest and of willingness on the part of
Okay.
Chris?
I thought you were drawing out my question. I was intrigued, Ambassador, that you talked, it made so much of the civilian space idea of the European Union's achievement, zone of peace and stuff, and indeed it's very important. But many people have thought, when looking at European foreign policy cooperation, that the external face of the civilian space is the idea of civilian power and international relations. Powerful idea in German circles. Now, which there are two models, obviously, of the way in which the European Union can behave in international relations, at least two, assuming it can get its act together, and you suggested perhaps it wasn't getting its act sufficiently together. One is the existing model of, by and large, forswearing the military instrument and using the notion of civilian power, and the other is of going down the road of a greater fusion with the Western European Union and developing a military arm and becoming, in a sense, more state-like, more conventional. Now, which is it that the United States would prefer? What does it hope to see come out of, for example, the next round of intergovernmental conference and the like for the Union?
The short answer to your question is both. The European civil space is not something that you consciously necessarily put together. It's a state of mind and habit and behavior. Deriving out of the experience of the last 50 years. There is a serious question about how far east that will move and can be moved in time. With regard to Western European Union, the United States is now firmly behind its increasing in effectiveness for a very simple reason. During the Cold War, we wanted a strong and robust European pillar essentially to do what we wanted it to do, because we had a central requirement to manage a nuclear strategic relationship with the Soviet Union. But today we don't have that. There is no Soviet Union, no central relationship of that nature. And so for us, having a Western European Union that's strong and effective is a good idea. It helps people to think about security. It goes part to this gentleman's question. It helps to promote the integrity of the European Union. Inevitably, it's got to have a foreign and security policy at some point. It helps to provide alternative structures here in Europe just in case people have a dwindling confidence in the United States, and it helps to do things in Central Europe. We don't see a conflict anymore. In fact, if I may be ironic, I'm the first U.S. ambassador to NATO. When WEU doesn't do anything very effective, I don't go blamed. It's not our fault. We're actually doing as much as just about anybody to try to make WEU work. So coming out of next year, we think the ideas put forward by the British government make a lot of sense. To go to this gentleman's question, I think this is one of the key things that we have to face. To what extent are we in our several countries going to recognize early this time that there are some things we can do which are relatively inexpensive to forestall the kinds of things that happened before? terrible human costs of Verdun that cost 800,000 lives for 2 square kilometers at the end, a World War II in the Holocaust, which is unmatched, a Cold War which cost my country $4 trillion and East and West nearly blew up the world, to find the political will to do the relatively inexpensive things, whether they're the economic and the political, European Union and others, or the relatively modest things we do at NATO. The cost of Partnership for Peace internally this year is about $15 million. The cost bilaterally, my country's putting up an extra $30 million this year, an extra $100 million next year. That's peanuts. But it's going to be important that the statesmen and women in the various countries tell the people of the various countries what it is can be done with a high payoff and a relatively low cost that is going to give us a brighter future than we had in the earlier part of this century. That's a matter of leadership. But it's also part of NATO keeping its job description as narrowly defined so that 16 countries are prepared to sign up for it. Obviously, if things went badly in Russia, that would give a great infusion of support. We want to see an infusion of support with things going well in Russia, because none of us have had the opportunity in this century to work upon and work with a country going through what it's going through now with a possibility of a productive outcome. But gaining the support and sustaining it is, as always, the toughest job if you want to get it done right early so you don't have to pay some horrendous price later on. Thank you very much.
Ambassador Hunter, I think we can all agree with Cedric Thornbury that we have enjoyed the tune, and you have given us a lot of words to ponder, and we shall do so with great gratitude as we go from here. There is a reception on the 5th floor in the senior common room for anyone who would like to come. We will be there shortly after Robert Hunter has just had a few words with the press outside. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you.